watch me cry. Stand up on mighty frame and say you rise. Welcome to Foundations for Life. This is Barry Phillips along with my esteemed co-host Mike Clayton. And tonight we've got one for you. we got a red hot good one tonight for you folks. Viet Se, and
we're speaking in faith here, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, you begin to see things as they really are. So, anyway, folks, I can tell you that behind the scenes, Mike and I both are on a path to. I don't know how you would express this, Mike, other than we're getting somewhere and we're seeing something. So it's exciting. Life's good. How are you?
It is, Barry. I'm doing great. I am absolutely doing fantastic. There's so much, as you said, going on in life. And I think one of the things that's being revealed to me, and I think to you also in this day, and we're going through it. You know, why is it that the Torah gives this, especially in the book of, in Bereshit, we start out with this journey of the patriarchs, and then we go into the journey of the Hebrews before the laws of Leviticus are laid out here, and we get to those. We first have to deal with the relationships of people as they're interacting, not just interacting with each other, interacting with their Elohim, and interacting with themselves. Mm-hmm. And so what are we seeing? We're seeing that a principle that it seems like, you know, after like 60 years of life, you would have gotten this a little earlier. I'm starting to realize what people told me 30, 40 years ago when they said, you know, if I'd have only known, you know, back then what I know now. And it's really kind of a thing of, you know, once you get life figured out, you die. because you figure out that life was not about the destination. Life was about the journey.
Uh-huh.
And the journey is about each of us becoming the person we're supposed to be. There is a person within each of us that he created us to be.
Okay.
And the walk of this life is about finding out and rising to the person that we were always created to be. The vast majority of people upon this earth don't even care. They could care less about becoming that person they were created. Because they, you know, we live in this evolutionary thing that, you know, great granddad was a slime pond who gave birth to a monkey, and now here we are, you know, just minus the tail. And so you have this concept. People don't even understand that there is a creator. But even for those that do, how many people that say they are following God, Elohim, Hashem, name how, you know, the creator, the almighty, name however you want to name this being that created the heavens and the earth. How many people wake up in the morning with a consideration of, Father, how do I become the person you created me to be?
You know, you got to be able to look in the mirror, Mike, and see the potential. You know, there's a couple of things that tend to happen. Either A, we overestimate ourselves in the idea that we think just because we are, we deserve. You know, somebody has told us that, you know, life should be free, that we should get everything handed to us, that they're, you know, it's just not fair that some have and some don't. You know, we got to level the play. That whole mantra, you know, there's that mindset. And then there are those that I saw yesterday. Laura and I were celebrating 36 years of marriage, and we just took a day.
Congrats.
And thank you. We went out and just to be out together. We had a couple meals out together yesterday. doing something like that we never do, at least not two meals in a day. But, you know, we did some things that we enjoy, one of which Laura wanted to go into one of these soap places, soaps and lotions deals.
Yeah,
I can't stand to go in the place. My nose, it just tears me up. So I'm sitting out in the main walk area of our local mall, and I'm people watching, which I'm very happy to do. Yesterday, among many things, I saw a grown man, a man in his 30s, standing with his belt in his pants somewhere around lower middle buttocks, exposing his underwear and his pants about to fall on the floor. And I thought, dude, don't you know your drawers are showing in public? And women are around, and he was oblivious. I was elsewhere in the mall, and I saw more of that. And I thought, dude, yeah, you know, where is your self-respect? Okay, you know, I'll give you it's a cultural thing, but still. I saw a young girl walk by the mall, major holes in her jeans to where not, it wasn't just, you know, the stylus rip thing. I mean, the whole front of her pants was missing. Hair had just slung back over his shoulders, slouchy, and a secondary shirt that was barely draped or, you know, enough on her shoulders to hold, to be there. And she had this empty, hollow face expression. She put on a bunch of makeup, but I mean, it was like, I'm just out here to be taken advantage of is what I saw. I don't care about me. I don't believe in me. And the world's going to take advantage of me. And I might as well make myself a target. Mike, I groaned.
Yeah.
You know, it's either one extreme. Everybody owes me everything. Or the other side of the extreme. Life offers me nothing. I'm not worth anything. Somewhere in the middle, you find a Yaakov.
Yeah.
I believe that when Yaakov left Beersheba, he believed in himself. He believed in himself enough to strategize and do what he had to do to get the blessing. He believed that he could handle it. He believed that he was the right person to get it. And he did what he had to do to get it. But now that he's got it, Yah says, I'm going to make you capable of this blessing. So when Yitzhak sent him out on this journey from Beersheba to go find his bride in Haran, he had, I don't know that Yitzhak understood what he was doing or not, but basically he was setting him on a path where Yah could pick him up in the middle of this journey and start molding the clay.
Yeah.
Saying, Yaakov, I see in you what you have no ability to see in yourself, but I'm not going to let this process stop until it's done. I didn't include it in our talking points, Mike, but he that has been, that has began a good work in us, is also faithful to bring it to completion. Dragging us down the road sometimes, kicking and screaming and protesting every step of the way. But he pushes us in on purpose into places to where we're forced to grow up and forced to deal with stuff so that we can learn. Okay,
well, I'm on my
soapbox. I didn't mean
that's okay. That's fine. A pretty good one. But I find it interesting that the first place he goes, he leaves Beersheba. The place of the seven wells.
Okay.
And he goes, and it says he traveled toward Haran. He came to a certain place and stayed the night there. This has been known as Beit El, and, you know, there is a town in Israel named Beit El. I personally do not believe that's where it was. I believe it was Mount Moriah. To think that Abraham going to Mount Moriah, offering Isaac on that mountain, you know, the place that he received the vision of the kingdom to come, that story had been told. You know, they weren't sitting around watching television television all day playing, playing the latest card game. Nah. They were telling stories about their lives. To imagine that Isaac would be sitting there with Jacob, a little boy, and with Esau as they were little children, and Jacob saying, "Abba, tell me the story again when Grandpa took you to that mountain." And all of a sudden they get old enough, and Yaakov says, "Abba, I want to go see the mountain." He says, "Okay, son. Okay. Next week we're going to go see the mountain." To think that he had not seen that mountain is way beyond my belief structure.
Well, Yaakov knew where that was. 60 years old here.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had been to that mountain. In fact, it is possible that he had been to that mountain over and over again, because if we go back and consider the possibility that Abraham had been going to that same mountain yearly, it is thought that that was the time that would later be known as Pesach. And so Abraham had been taking Isaac to that mountain yearly. When he took him and that infamous year that he said, "Dad, didn't you forget something? You forgot the lamb. Dad, where's the lamb?" "God will provide. Don't worry, son. Yeah, I'll provide." This would have passed on. I don't think this was the first time that Yaakov came to there. So what did he do? When he left his father's house, he connected with the Elohim of his grandfather and the Elohim of his father. He went to Mount Moriah and he lays down, he takes a stone. It says he took a stone from the place, put it under his head and laid down to sleep. Is that one of the stones that had been used for the altar that his father had laid upon?
Ooh. Now that's an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
This is not outside of any boundaries. In fact, this is, to me, the most common sense thing that could have happened. This guy has left his father's house. He knows now that he is carrying the blessing. He is carrying the blessing of the covenant of the firstborn. So where would he go? He would go back to connect. But yet there was still something that needed to happen there. And it says that night he laid down and suddenly Hashem was standing next to him and introduced himself and says, "I am the Elohim of Abraham, your grandfather, and the Elohim of Isaac." And he doesn't say to him, "And I'm going to redeem you." He doesn't say, "I'm going to, you know." He doesn't say, "And I'm going to die upon a tree for you." What does he say? He says, "I'm going to give you this land." He says the same thing. Go back to Genesis chapter 12. When he brought Abraham into the land, he said, "I'm going to give you this land." In Isaac, "I'm going to give you this land." In Jacob, "I'm going to give you this land." Am I belittling the point? No. I'm not the one that started this. I'm not the one that started this thing about that the covenant is about occupying the land. That's not to take anything away from the death, resurrection of Messiah, but the death and resurrection of Messiah is about a people that are occupying a land.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not the one that started this overemphasis on the land. The Almighty did. Blame him before you email me.
Okay. So, covenant has the land considered, the land understood. The idea that covenant is only about redemption is to cut off at least half of the benefit. We are redeemed to inherit.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not really teaching people that, Mike. We're you know, you've been redeemed to make your life better.
Yeah. We are trying to do that.
Yeah, we're trying. Yeah. And, that's something that's got to be decreed and declared. It's not just about, you know, your redemption. It's not a self-improvement technique. This is the beginning of a schooling so that you will be capable of inheriting the land and knowing what to do with it.
Okay, stop. Just stop a minute. So you're equating that many people see salvation as another form of a 12-step program?
It's commonly said, you know, come down to the altar, pray this prayer, and your life is going to change for the better.
So what we need to do next is we need to get, before the sinner's prayer, we need to have everybody make 12 steps to the altar. I am making fun a little bit. I know that has worked for some people, but also at the same time, I personally believe that redemption is one step. It is one step toward Him. But that one step also includes an inheritance of a land and being part of a kingdom and being part of a people. And so with Yaakov, he is told that from there, okay, your descendants are going to be as the grains of the dust of the land, which is the same promise he gave to Abraham.
Yeah.
And then he says, I'm going to expand you to the west and to the east, to the north and the south, but I'm going to expand you from the land. The land is going to be your central point, and everything is going to go forth from that place, which sounds a lot like what you said in Acts chapter 1, you shall be my witnesses in Yerushalayim, in Yehuda, in the Shomron, and then to the ends of the earth.
Well, let's explain that a little bit. Yaakov, to some level, was already a Tzaddik, a righteous man. That being said, consider Abraham praying, if there are 10 righteous men, you know, he started out with, you know, more than that. But if there are 10 righteous men in the cities of the plain, they would have enough righteous influence over those cities, Yah said, to spare them judgment. So a Tzaddik living in a certain community, a group of Tzaddiks or Zedekin living in a community has or should have influence and effect enough to bring about protection and guard. When Moshe said to those going in to look into the land, see if there are any trees there, trees mm-hmm. being a symbol of a Tzaddik or Zedekin,
mm-hmm.
if there are Zedekim living in any community, we're not going to try to rise up against that community, is what was being said. So there is righteous influence. So when a Tzaddik, even of the statue, whatever it would be at this point for Yaakov, when he leaves, the righteousness and benefit of that man leave that area and go with him. There is a vacuum. What is vacuums normally filled with? Either another righteous man steps into that place or unrighteousness begins to take its place. So Yeshua said, start off in Jerusalem, go to Yehuda, then to Shomron, and then to the ends of the earth. In other words, I believe what he was saying, build up a community of Zedekim in Yerushalayim before you go to the outer regions of Yehuda and build up the community there. Then go to Shomron and then go to the ends of the earth. Don't go running off to the ends of the earth without establishing a righteous community and base to operate from where you've already been. Mike, oftentimes we're trying to jump from step one to step 10 not having a proper foundation of where we've been. When you go to a congregation and the congregation requires a struggle from you, Maybe it's not what you think it ought to be. You might want to consider, instead of saying this ain't for us and we peel out of there, it could be Yah has sent you there to be a Zadik in that community to yield righteous influence. That doesn't mean obnoxious influence, but righteous influence to help build that community. Realize that you take that with you. I'm thinking of, we talk about this a little bit later on. Yeshua says, if a community won't receive your witness, your righteousness, your effect, leave them, go on to somebody else. We'll talk more about that later on. But okay. Go ahead.
Okay, but I want to back you up just a little bit, okay, in this thing of being a Zadik. So what I'm hearing out of this is very simple. If your house is not in order, you have no business going to Mexico on an evangelical trip.
Well, that's another way of saying it.
Just went ahead and said it straight. How many people are trying to go to a congregation and change the righteousness of the congregation, but yet their own house is out of order? Until your house, until you have established righteousness within the boundaries of your house, your family, your home, you have no business trying to establish righteousness somewhere else.
That's step one, eh?
Mm-hmm.
That's step.
So this is what the disciples were doing. They were establishing righteousness within their own boundaries. And once you establish righteousness within those boundaries, then you can talk to somebody else. And then you can talk to somebody else.
Well, that's what we see is taking place in Yaakov. Yah is saying to him, you're going to come back and this land is going to be filled with righteousness. I'm going to give you this land. And you're going to inherit the whole of the land. Well, Yaakov couldn't do that by himself.
Mm-hmm.
He had to raise up a nation to do that.
But so what's his
next step is go build his own family. Mm-hmm. And that if you're going to see the big picture, start with your home.
So he had to be sent out into exile to find his righteousness.
Well, could it be that Daddy and Grandpa's righteousness and example was already prominent there? He needed to go and he couldn't just dwell in the shadows of that which had already been established. He needed to find a place to grow.
He had to become his own man. And something about it that he could not become that man within the boundaries of his granddad and his father. He had to be sent far away. The prodigal son had to be sent to a foreign country to become the Zadik.
Laura and I had to, our first adventure, 5.5 hours drive from mom and dad. We had no family, nobody knew nobody, completely new town. It was a wake-up call, but boy, we grew up real fast.
Mm-hmm.
Real fast.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Hey, we've gotten through. We almost made it through chapter 28. And we're going to come back because there's still a little bit more meat on the bone before we move on to the next chapter. Welcome back to another exciting segment of Foundations for Life with Barry Phillips and Mike Clayton. This segment, folks, is different than all the rest as it comes with a money-back guarantee. Which doesn't affect a lot of people because some people don't give. And that's my segue, Barry. That's my segue, too. And when Yaakov stands after this dream, and he says, and it says in verse 20, Yaakov took this vow. The David Stern translates it as, if Elohim will be with me. But I, in the limited amount of Hebrew study that I have, I believe it should be better translated, when Elohim will be with me. Guard me. Give me bread, give me clothes to wear, and I will return to this place. He says, and then everything, I will faithfully return one-tenth to you.
Another translation says, because you will be with me.
Yeah.
Which it goes hand in hand with what Yah later on says to Israel, that he gives them the ability to get wealth to establish his kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is not about wealth and prosperity only. I mean, but poor and broke don't build kingdoms too well either.
No, it doesn't. In fact, I've been doing something, trying to do something just the last few days before I start teaching this coming up in the coming month. I've been going back and reading one of the Proverbs coinciding with the day of the month. It's amazing how much it speaks about this subject. But he knew, okay, he's going into exile, but he knew that the Father was going to be with him. He was trusting. He was putting his faith in the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Yaakov. But there's an interesting little twist here in the center of it. It says, so that I will return to my Father's house in peace, then Hashem will be my Elohim. There's an amazing thing about the Creator. He doesn't mind being put to the test by people.
No.
You know, I don't see that somewhere along the way as Yaakov is making this great declaration there, that in the heavens it's that you feel this nervous shaking by Hashem. Oh no, if I can just handle this time that he's going to be in exile, then he's going to receive me. He's like laughing, going, "You ain't seen nothing, buddy. You just wait and see. You're asking for bread and clothes? I got a life in store for you.
I'll give you a whole flock of uncountable sheep to get wool from, so you can have all the clothes you want."
Yeah. Now, I don't think that Yaakov should have been coming back blaming him for the two wives and the two concubines, but that's kind of the way it worked, you know. But he says, and I will bring back to you, I will give to you a tenth of all. That is before the commandment in Leviticus about tithing.
Uh-huh.
He was committing to what he had seen or heard from his grandfather. The story, to imagine these stories, and this is something, Barry, if the greatest tragedy of our day, in my opinion, is the television, the internet, and people relying on those two things instead of turning it off and looking across a child, looking across a room at a grandfather and saying, tell me again that story. I remember those days growing up when I'd sit there spellbound on the couch, not moving, hardly breathing, as my granddad would tell stories about hunting and fishing. I remember those stories. That's tragic. That families do not communicate at that level. But we see that communication. And because of this, Yaakov is leading is leaving as a tzaddik, as a righteous man, with the intent to bring back to the land of Israel. Where was he going to give that money to? That tithe, whatever it was, by that time he was probably ready to give at least one of the kids away. Here, I brought you one of my wives, one of my concubines, and three children. Okay. As he makes that statement, there's no temple there. There's no Levitical priesthood there. How's he going to do that? What's in his mind that he's thinking that he's going to give unto the Almighty, who, by the way, it says he's standing beside him? There is a presentation of Hashem, a manifestation of Hashem, I believe that to be the Messiah, who is standing next to Yaakov, and he's speaking to him. And he says, when I come back here, 10th of it is yours, man. Or God, or what exactly are you? You are, I'm going to bring that 10th to you.
He is at least prophetically speaking that his sons will give to Levi.
Yeah.
There's a couple other things here before we jump out of this chapter. I don't want to belabor the point here. I just noticed that there was today, as I was thinking through this, Yaakov and Rav Shaul both encounter Yeshua while they're on a journey.
Mm.
Both of them hear his voice. Both of them encounter a version of the bride,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And in finding the bride, both of them are met with heavy resistance. Both of them have to work long years to get what they're called or accomplished to get it accomplished. And both of them found that the bride is a lot more complicated than they would have imagined. I just thought that was an interesting parallel there. Not that I'm saying that Rav Shaul is Yaakov, but it's a similar path, and one and their journeys, if just put it that way.
But ladies, just remember, it was Barry Phillips that said that the bride is much more complicated than the husband will ever know.
That's because the bride I'm referring to includes men.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Nice dig.
Yeah.
I saw the bus coming. I tried to throw you under it, and you backstepped on me. Okay, nice save.
Yeah, you're not going to drown me unnecessarily. So, one other quick point here is this year we're tying the Torah portion to the Brit Chadashah, and Yochanan chapter number one. I just always found this very fascinating. When Yeshua is conversing with Nathanael, mm-hmm. and Nathanael says, when did you see me? And he said, I saw you when you were under the fig tree. Maybe the fig tree referencing the Sanhedrin. I saw you when you were studying and under their authority, if you will. I don't know how that played to him. But Yeshua said, greater than this shall you see. Truly, truly, I say to you that from now on you shall see the heaven open and the messengers of Elohim ascending and descending upon the Son of Adam. Yeshua just described himself as the stairway, the ladder, the Salem, if you will, that Yaakov saw.
Mm.
And basically he is saying, the messengers of heaven, they ascend and descend by me, by my authority, according to my purposes. I have to ask a question, Mike, not to get off in angelology and all that kind of thing, but I have to wonder, are we missing a great resource of ability by not even, I'm not saying we should be preoccupied with messengers, by no means. And there are those that have done so.
Mm-hmm.
But understand that the messengers are a party to what we are doing. They are involved at the command of Yeshua. And when we're doing the work of the kingdom, when we're laboring in his behalf, We should understand messengers will work with us, doing that which we are not able to do. Working behind the scenes or working in the unseen realm, effecting things. So, you know, this is not human effort alone.
So Barry, to disregard this principle, I mean, when we look in the book of Acts with Peter, Kepha, you know, he's laying there in jail asleep, and he can't get out of there. So a messenger, an angel, comes and unlocks the door and tells him to get up and get his clothes on. It does not appear from the narrative of the account in the book of Acts that Kepha was in any way frightened, astonished, amazed, or surprised. In fact, it is almost, and I guess I'm kind of reading into it a little bit because we're not told this, but it was like, hey, I'm going to sleep. God's got this. And, you know, when he's ready for me to get out, I guess somebody will come along and wake me up. And yeah, an angel did. So it's almost as if at that time he's expecting the hand of the Almighty to work within his midst.
I see another place here in Acts 27, the shipwreck that Rob Shaul
was on. Yeah.
He said, tonight a messenger of the Elohim to whom I belong, and whom I've served, stood by me saying, do not be afraid, Shaul, for you have to be brought before Caesar. And look, Elohim has favorably given you all who sail with you. I got to tell you, there's been many a time that I've been on a plane flight and the turbulence gets a little rough. And I prayed, Father, I have a destination to get to. I have a purpose. I have a destiny that I need to complete. And I'm asking that you not only get me there safely, but you give me everyone that's on this plane with me. And after praying that, there's a sense of calm and assurance. Mm-hmm. You know, this plane's not going down. This plane's not going to have an issue. We've got this. And, you know, understand that when you travel, when you move, when you go, you should be taking righteous influence with you when you go. Not only that you will be guarded, but those that are with you should be.
So what about the difference of praying for angelic help out of fear versus out of companionship, of asking that angelic messengers would walk with us and would help us?
Yeah. The only way I know to answer that, Mike, I can tell you a true story very quickly. Laura, my wife, has been apt to pray, you know, especially when the kids were little. Father, I pray you station an angel at the head, the foot, and the sides of the children's bed. Like, it took four messengers around two little kids to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a situation at that time when the kids were little where we were in a town that was well understood to be involved in sorcery, witchcraft, etc. And we knew that there was one who was involved in such things right catty corner, right across the street from us. And the spiritual warfare was super intense in this town. I'd wake up in the middle of the night fighting demons and type stuff. I mean, it was just wild. So we were praying. I was praying, Father, I pray you station a ring of angels around our property here and guard us. Yah gave me an answer and a vision to his, or gave me a vision of his answer to that prayer. I saw one tall messenger, and the guy must have been 15 foot tall. And he was standing out at the corner of our lot between my home and what I knew was to be our adversary. And he was just a sentinel standing guard. And every once in a while, he would look back over his shoulder toward my home, but he was facing our adversary and keeping them at bay.
Mm-hmm.
I had the sudden sense of overwhelming shalom. I didn't need a ring of angels standing locked arm in arm. Yahweh's let me know I've got one and he can handle it. And I was reminded of how one messenger went into the enemy's camp and what was it, 128,000 died in one night. You know, the forces of darkness are no match for what Yah has available in his arsenal for us.
You know, over the years, Kathy has had, I've been on the road traveling now for 20 years, and Kathy's had a lot of time that she's been at home. And, it, you know, I like to live in the country. We were in Oklahoma. And it was quite the, you know, we had 75 acres there, and it was mostly wooded, and we'd hear coyotes and, you know, I mean, right next to us, really, we've seen coyotes in the yard, and the closest neighbor is about a half mile away, which is really the way that I like to live. But, you know, she had been praying for, you know, protection for angelic beings. And one of a mutual acquaintance, one of my board members was there at the house one day, and he's standing at the back door, and he said, "Well, he's big." Kathy said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "There is a huge angel that stands at the doorway of your house." And it was like, yeah. I mean, it's not just that you get shalom at that moment. You get courage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the creator of the universe has placed one of his angelic guards. So to not, and this is, I mean, my mind's going all kinds of different directions on this one. to not, and it's, I'm not going to put my faith in angelic beings. My faith is in the Creator, but he has these beings for his purposes. So even to go back, Barry, and to go to the heart and, folks, if you think we're getting all the way to the end of this Torah portion, yeah, that ain't happening.
We might get out of chapter 28.
We may. Here's a reason. Here's something to think about. That Yaakov, when he leaves his father, the first place that he goes is the place, I believe, the place of Mount Moriah, the place of the offering. Why? Because he knew that he could not do this walk by himself. To wake up in the morning, and I'm so guilty of this, trying to put things in my life to where it changes this. To wake up in the morning and to not have any time at all in prayer, even if it's 5 minutes, even if it's 10 minutes, to not have some type of a momentary communication with the Almighty in the first moments of our day is to say, I really don't need you. I got this by myself.
Oh, boy. That's not wise. Not wise.
Now, what does it take for us to change that? Just to do something. To do something in our morning to where, even if it's kind of a multitasking thing at first, but something in the morning that I can stay, that I can just a few minutes, acknowledging I'm not really getting through. I can get through a day by myself. I mean, I've proven that. I can get through a day by myself. My day may not be very productive, but I can get through it. I'm talking about being productive. I said something, you know, before we came on the air, we have our own time of prayer. And I heard these words that as I was praying them, I heard myself saying these words, may this program tonight be productive for your kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we stating that in the morning, no matter what we're doing? May my life today be productive for your kingdom. I think this is the heart of what Yaakov is praying.
Right.
I'm taking this journey. This journey is going to be about me becoming who you created me to be. and I'm going to be productive, even though I'm going to be in a place outside of the land, at a place of exile, I trust that I am going to be productive. He asked for bread, bread along the way, and clothing. How much is 10% of that? Not a lot. You know, you're bringing back two crackers and a, you know, and a dirty T-shirt.
Yeah.
He is stepping out and saying, you're leading me to go to a place that's outside of these boundaries that you've set up, but I know that you're going to make me productive in that. And because I trust that, I make a vow to you that whatever of production that I have out there, I will come back with it and I will offer it before you.
Mm-hmm. So he was anticipating this journey is going to be prosperous to some degree. Mm-hmm. And it was. I mean, he went across with this, his staff and his cloak, and he came back leading, you know, groups and a huge family. So in chapter 29, chapter 29.
The very first. No, go ahead.
We see one more time a picture of the bride being found at the well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, what
a barren bride, by the way, a barren bride at the well. He didn't know that yet.
No. You know, but Sarah was originally barren. Rivka was originally barren. Raquel is originally barren.
And actually, all were met at a well.
Leah was actually originally barren.
Yeah.
But they were all met at a well. There was a barren woman. And Yochanan chapter 4, met at a well. And every time I think about that woman, I weep. But she was barren because she was lost in doctrine. And she was a part of a people that the covenant carriers had shunned.
Yeah.
Not willing that they should have any benefit or recognition of the covenant.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But Yeshua went to find her and to include her.
Yeah.
That's what Yaakov went. He went to find a woman beautiful but barren to include her. If he had gone only for fertility's sake, I'm only interested in a woman that can give me children, he probably would not have chosen Rivka, or not Rivka, but Rebecca, Raquel, excuse me. I'll get it out here in a second. He may have seen fertility in Leah and only chosen her. But Yah had, you know, as much as we speak about the rejection of Leah and, you know, we glamorize Barbie doll Raquel. Raquel was a broken woman on the inside as much as her sister was.
Just in different ways.
In a different way.
Yeah, totally in different ways. They each had their issues. You know, Raquel, yeah, it's Rachel. Raquel. Now that we got, I mean, I had a hard enough time figuring it out when it was just in English. Now I got Hebrew to throw in there too. You know, Raquel looked perfect on the outside, but had issues on the inside.
She's the Laodicean congregation.
Mm-hmm.
You got everything you think you need, but inside you're still broken.
You're a mess. You're a mess. In fact, it's possible that, you know, Leah actually had more going for her on the inside. She just didn't have the outward appearance. So if you judge by the outward appearance, you're never going to come up with the right answer. That's another little thought process there.
But we have come up with music, huh?
Oh, again?
Welcome back to Foundations for Life with Mike Clayton, myself, Barry Phillips, and we are urgently trying to move into a little bit of chapter 29, but you know, we're going to make every step of the journey count, so here we go. Mike, I love the prophetic pictures and symbols that I see in the Torah, and I learned quite early on in studying the Torah, nothing is in the Torah by accident. I love the rabbinical principle that says that everything that's supposed to be in there is in there, and nothing that is supposed to be in there is missing. So there's points where we say, I wish we had more information. He left out a big part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And other parts is like, he said it 3 or 4 times. Why did he do that? Well, that's exactly right. We are supposed to look and understand. So when it begins to describe this picture that takes place early on in chapter 29, we see that there is a field with a well in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's 3 flocks of sheep and a large stone on the well's mouth, and these details about what's going on here. Just what I saw. 3 flocks. There's Yehuda, there's Benjamin, there's Levi. That's the house of Yehuda. They have trouble removing the stone, which is the stone of stumbling. Because they can't get the stone off of the well, they're not drinking from the waters or the well, the living waters. In comes Yaakov, who carries the covenant. The covenant is the key to understanding what this stone of stumbling is, who it is. It is the strength of the covenant that enables the stone not to be thrown off onto the side of the ground, but to be lifted up. Then all the flocks can drink from the waters that are living, including the flock of Yosef that comes mm-hmm. when Rachel shows up. Does that make sense to you, or is that just reading too much in it?
Oh, no, that's totally what I got out of this today. I read over that one, and it was like, okay, here we go. So until the one that's prophesied, I mean, the Messiah being prophesied all through this is the one who rolls the stone away. So he's the first rolling stone.
Uh-oh.
Or rolling.
I don't know.
Okay. Roller of the stone or something. I don't know. Should have let that one go, but I didn't.
No,
sometimes you fall in these traps, folks. So it says that we can't, not until all the flocks have been gathered together. Barry, what hit me today is this. We can never, the house of Israel, can never drink of the depths of the Mayim Chaim, the living waters, until all the tribes are gathered together.
Well, Mike, we think that, you know, because we know who Messiah is and that we've accepted his redemption, that we're already there. But there is a revelation and a level of understanding, a drink of water that is yet to come
mm-hmm.
that we haven't tasted of yet.
So think of it this way, Barry. If you're right, and this is prophetic of Yehuda, Benjamin, and Levi, that is at the well, and then we see that the tribes of Rachel, which would go to Joseph, okay, Ephraim, what are they drinking? At the moment, they're out drinking from other wells.
Hmm.
Ephraim has been drinking of other wells than the wells are supposed to drink of. Just another little thought there. Another little thought. So, you know, yeah.
I could spend all day, you know, some of the timing, you know, it's not the right time for them to be here. Why are they not out grazing? Well, it's, you know, we're waiting on the water so they can graze. And then it's Joseph's mother. You know, the time, they didn't understand timing. And then the, you know, the mother of Mashiach ben Yosef shows up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more to dig in there, more to dig. But for the sake of time, years earlier, a servant of Abraham shows up to Laban's house, and he is laden down with gifts and riches and presents. And Laban hears that his sister's boy is showing up, and he's probably expecting, I wonder how many camels he brought with him. He shows up with a stick.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? He looks at him and says, son, where's your camels at? Where are the guests at? It's just me. It's just me. You know.
Now, there is a rabbinic study on, and I was just reading this today from Nachman Kahana, that when Yaakov left the house of his father, that he actually left with camels, with goods.
Yes.
That he did not send him out on his own. Now, we don't know this. It's not proven either way, but the son of Esau was sent to kill Yaakov. And so instead of killing him, he stole everything he had. He left him as a destitute person.
Yeah.
Only, you know, that he left him with his clothes and his stick, his staff, believing that to leave him destitute was the same as killing him. And so the story goes on that Esau was extremely angry at his son until his son told him, "Dad, I did this for a reason. If I'd have killed him, your anger would have just been for the moment. You would have had no contentment in years to come. But because I stole everything from him, you can think of him laying in the desert, freezing at night because he didn't have a coat, destitute, begging for bread, and you can be content that he's suffering every day of his life." And so Esau was satisfied in that he had passed on the hatred for Yaakov to his son.
Mm.
Now, again, we don't know if this is true, but what we do see is that Yaakov comes to Laban. Laban is his name means white, so he looks like a Zadik on the outside. Yaakov has grown up in
white
the shadows.
White kind of references is righteousness, not necessarily a race.
Yeah, right. Yeah, thank you very much. He has grown up in the household of Zadiks, of Abraham, of Yitzhak. And so now he's looking for another man of righteousness, a man of holiness, white standing for righteousness. And he sees this man whose name is righteous, but inside of him there's no righteousness at all. He invites him to come into his house, and interesting, he stays there a month. It's like, you know, Laban's like, okay, why don't you just stick around? Why is he doing this? Probably that he's convinced that if I just stand here on this porch long enough, the camels are going to show up. Somebody's going to send the camels after this boy. He's looking for wealth. He's looking for the scheme here. And so it's at that point, you know, why should you work for me for nothing? You know, just because you're my relative, you know, tell me how much I should pay you. In other words, you know, I'll give you a little stipend. I'll give you minimum wage. And because if you stay around long enough, somebody's going to come looking for you. And they're probably going to have camels. Continues on and on and on.
Well, you know, LaVon had to ask him, so how's sister doing?
Yeah.
She's well. Yeah. She's you know, her and dad are quite well off.
Yeah.
You know, they're blessed. I see LaVon as the, I'll be careful how I say this, the spiritual leader, whether he is in one congregation or study hall or wherever he's at. To seize the skills and talents of a young potential protege and uses them for his own advancement.
Mm-hmm.
How many, you know, I can only say this because this has been my experience. A pastor looks at a young man and sees gifts and talents, some abilities, and thinks, if I can get him on staff, he can help me grow my thing, do my thing, be my thing. And when that one is worn out, he goes and gets another one.
Mm-hmm.
There are men and women, if you will, of all sorts and varieties, and not just in the spiritual field, who will burn up young, idealistic talent for their own purposes. And, you know, he was perfectly content. He looked later next week, I think it is. He looks at Yaakov and says, "Everything you got's mine. I gave it to you."
And anybody that doesn't believe that is true, I have a very good friend, a man that's becoming a very close friend of mine right now. I just introduced to him recently. That's his story. That is his story of a person in ministry that pretty much used him and then spit him out. And this happens over and over. This does not just happen in the business world.
It happens.
But you take somebody that just comes out of Bible school, they're starry-eyed, they've got dreams, ambitions, they've got the energy, they've got all of this. And they think that everybody is righteous. They think that they're looking at the outside. It's like, you know, the first pastor that, you know, that I looked at, I was like, he's like, you know, one step from the Pope or something. and he was a good man. I mean, he was a good man. But I've seen a lot of pastors that on the outside, they look white. They look pure. They look holy. They look righteous. They look like tzaddiks. On the inside, they're money-hungry jerks.
That's not every pastor. That is
no.
a select few.
Yeah, yeah. I wish it was just a very few, but I'd love to qualify that as just a very few. But I'm not, and that same thing happens in Messianic Hebrew Root circles too.
I'm sure. Yes.
Yeah, it does. It does. So we see that Yaakov has kind of met his match a little bit, and the boy's going to need to learn some discernment. Interesting enough, you know, he bargains for Raquel. And why is it, Barry? I was thinking about this today. He's not a real good negotiator. I mean, why not start with 6 months? You know, I'll work for you for 6 months for your daughter. He begins the deal at 7 years. Laban accepts it immediately. Well, anybody that's ever been done anything in negotiations understands that when somebody accepts your deal immediately, you offered way too much. Now, of course, you know, you have some spiritual insights that are, go ahead.
Maybe he was trying to convey the value that he saw in the daughter. She's so awesome. I will work 7 years for you to get her.
You a 7-year woman.
She must have been something else. I got to tell you, she must have been just something else.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
anyway,
we better. before I say something just totally stupid that causes me some problems, would you keep going?
Well, the word I was wanting to go with all of this before Mike went off on his hayride here, I think LeVon was disappointed, like people were disappointed in the appearance of Yeshua.
Yeah.
He didn't show up in king's robes and bring in the kingdom, delivering from Rome. He came as Mashiach ben Yosef. And because of that disappointment, they wanted to use Yeshua like LeVon wanted to use Yaakov for mm-hmm. whatever benefit they could mm-hmm. get from him. But they saw no real outstanding value in him. And so when Yeshua began to establish something other, the leadership, the religious leadership, was claiming it for their own. These people belong to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I was teaching last week in Yochanan chapter 11, Caiaphas prophesies, don't you know that it's better that one died for the nation? In other words, if one will die for the nation, then everybody doesn't have to die. It's either him or all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a realization that if the Romans come in and take all of this, we'll lose our place. Mm-hmm. We'll lose our prestige. We'll lose, you know, our name. We can't do that. And so that was the mindset. Let Yeshua take it on the chin. You know, it's no problem for us. Same picture here.
You know, so what we see is with Raquel is she had no former outward beauty that you should that Jacob should behold her, right?
Leah,
yeah. So the same as with the religious leaders of the day, they were looking at outward appearance instead of inward anointing.
Yes.
Now, when we go on with the account, I think that some may have the thought, understanding, that he worked an additional 7 years for Raquel and then was married to her. But the scripture says that actually, you know, he gets to marry her after the first week, but he's committed to work another 7 years because for Rachel.
So he has, man, it's yeah.
You know, here's where it gets kind of interesting as it goes along. So Yaakov wakes up the next morning and figures out, that's not who I bargained for. That's not who I worked 7 years for. You know, if he'd have been told that he was going to be marrying Leah, what was his negotiations going to be? I'll work about 7 days. In fact, in his mind, Leah is only pretty much worth 7 days. He says, you know, you continue the marriage week with her, and then I will give you Rachel.
Now, every time I think about this, Mike, I realize that one, at that first night, Leah understood what the genuine, heartfelt passion of Yaakov was like.
Mm-hmm.
Because in his mind, that was Raquel. Immediately, in the remainder of the week, she realized, I have married an angry man.
I'm thinking... Okay, go ahead, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, then afterwards, after he had also taken Raquel, she knew he is given that first night passion that he gave me to her, and I can tell the difference every time that we're together. It's just not the same. She knew for the rest of her life, I don't have him, his complete heart.
So
So when we could, as the body of Messiah in the house of Joseph, talk about our passion for him, our celebration of him, our great love for him, how that we just worship and adore him. The house of Yehuda says, it's about duty. It's about being faithful. It's about continuing on with what we know to be required.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the line in the movie, Defiance. Is it Defiance? Where the rabbi is among the group that is escaping the Nazis out in the woods. And he says, please give this gift to someone else. We've suffered long enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we have been dutiful. We have fulfilled our role. We have been faithful. But where's the passion?
Well, even to the point that, you know, after this passionate evening with who he thinks is Raquel, he finds out it's Leah. He says, you know, okay, carry on with your week and then I'll give you Raquel. It is possible that the intimacy ended. And the rest of her marriage week was spent with him having longing eyes for her sister.
Yeah.
Now, eventually, because it says in verse 31 that Hashem saw that Leah was unloved, so he made her fertile. You know, they were having some kind of relationships, but Leah knew his heart wasn't in it.
It was just duty.
So, yeah, kind of going back where you were at there a little bit, are people... I'd hesitate to say something about, you know, Sunday morning from 11 to 12, because there are just as many people going to on Shabbat from 1 to 3.
Yes. True. True.
And it's just out of duty.
There's the truth. Yes.
Because the real love is not having to do anything, is not there. The real love is where I get to go afterwards. I get to go to a game. I get to go to the mall. I get to go to this. I get to go to that. But I've got a duty that I've got to perform.
Mm.
Yeah, that hurt. That hurt. Are we opening the Torah on Shabbat because it's our duty to do so? Or we open the Torah because it's our love to do so?
Mm. Wow.
It's, you know, there comes a point in time that, you know, intimacy is something you have to continue to work at.
Intimacy cannot be autopilot. I mean, you have to, for intimacy, spiritual, relational, however, it has to be focused on. It has to become purposeful. It has to become intentional. And, you know, I don't know, my mind is running in many directions with that.
Especially, well, that's okay. You don't have any time left, so you can try to find it, and we'll come back on the other side of the break with Barry's Mind.
Let the watchman cry.
And it's now the final half hour. Actually, it's not even a half an hour. You're getting shortchanged because it's 25 minutes. Last segment. Foundations for Life. Barry Phillips, Mike Clayton. Barry, we get into the place of the girls begin to have children. And, what amazing. I was with some mutual friends the other night, last weekend, actually, and we were talking about all this and the dysfunction. And I said, yeah, well, you know, hey, we had our forefathers and our foremothers. And I thought that the lady of the house was going to fall on the floor. But because we do have four mothers here, two brides, two concubines, and the dysfunction that comes out of this. So anybody wants to talk about this, this multiple wife thing, read this chapter.
Oh, my.
We're still paying for this one, Barry.
What was he thinking?
He wasn't.
He was reacting. I mean, that's okay. Okay, take my concubine. I take my maidservant.
How'd that work out for Granddad? You know, hey, when Sarah says to Abraham about Hagar, how'd that work out?
Not so hot.
Yeah, it didn't work out for Dad, but it'll sure work for me, you know.
So you got Leah here, Mike, that is looking for an advantage through childbearing. Okay, I don't have the looks that Raquel does, but she's barren, and I'm obviously fertile because I keep getting pregnant. And every time she has a child, she thinks that this is going to give her leverage against her sister. So you got these two houses competing.
Mm-hmm.
We're still competing, and we're still thinking that somehow whatever we do is going to give us leverage against the other, and that the father is going to love us more than the other house. It's never going to work out that way, ever, because he loves us both the same. The idea that he loves us former church folks because we've turned to the Torah, and he's going to love us more than our brother Yehuda and more than the folks that we left behind. We need to get over it. That ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't love us any more or any less than he does anyone else in the house. And that's whether we say it, where we think it, I think it's a subtle thing that goes on in our spiritual minds, and it's a fallacy. It's not good thinking.
You know what would have happened if Leah had just been herself? You know, instead of trying to prove something through her, Kathy's a little ways away from the phone there, so she'll get that in a second. It's what happens on Wednesday night. This is the night that our daughter calls, and so that's what it sounds like. But what's the chances that if she'd have just been who she was? I mean, we will see, and we've read the story, okay? So we know what happens in the end. And Leah's the one that's actually buried with Yaakov to give away the story at the end. She ends up becoming the wife that's closest to him. So what if she had just been who she was instead of this competition? These two women begin this competitive mode, and it just goes down the tubes.
Well, it goes into future generations as well.
Oh yeah, I've said this numerous times that it's amazing that the most dysfunctional family to ever be recorded on planet Earth will one day be the standard of righteousness upon the world, in the world.
Amazing.
You know, that's a long shot. Nobody would have put odds on that one. If anybody would have looked back, you know, if you brought Vegas into this and said, okay, give me odds, the family of Yaakov is going to be the standard for righteousness 3,000 years or so in the future, this would have been the total long shot here.
Wouldn't it though?
Yeah, but this is the way it's going to be. So this competition between the two wives and then bringing in the concubines along with it, but that same spirit of competition is so alive and well today. And I've seen this, you know, when one pastor or congregational leader is driving a newer car than the other one, they have a bigger building than the other one. Somebody, you know, in the congregation, you know, this happens. I've told the story numerous times of one of your, the people that said your congregation, we went to play golf with, I pulled up in the parking lot of the golf course and he's driving a yellow Corvette convertible with a license plate that says Teshuva. And it's like, I don't like Corvettes really. I've never driven one, never cared to. I had to get my truck safety recall yesterday and I walked into the showroom. There's a Corvette there, $102,000. It's only got two seats, doesn't even have a pickup bed. You know, what use is that? But I drove up and, you know, I saw this and all of a sudden it's like, well, I can't afford that. And it was just as instantaneous as I've ever had anything to come to me. The reason he was given that Corvette, and I actually preached this in your congregation the next day. The reason he was given that Corvette had nothing to do with him. It had to do with this, checking my attitude. Because the fastest way to shut down the blessings of Hashem in your life is to become jealous over somebody else's blessings. You want to open, I believe that the way to open up the blessings of Hashem in your life is to celebrate others' blessings. When we learn to celebrate the blessings of another instead of become jealous, it may be that that is what's stopping up our own conduit of blessing.
You know, you don't have to be a rich person to be greedy.
Oh, no.
Greed is the lust for money, and poor folks can have it as bad as anybody else.
In fact, a little bit more. In fact, poor people, a person on welfare can become more greedy than a person with $1 million in the bank because they will disdain everyone that is walking in blessing.
Mm. So, Mike, in chapter 30, I see this thing where Raquel starts pressuring Yaakov, give me children or I die. And when I see that, she is a picture of those who are always looking to somebody else to fix their world, to provide fulfillment or completion or their satisfaction. And what that often means is those folks are very misguided about what their own role is. She was wanting Yaakov to do for her what she felt incapable to do for herself. Now, obviously, it takes two parents to bring forth children. I get that. But relationally speaking, she's looking to someone else to fix it for her. And you have to be focused on doing what I know to do and listening for the extra that I need to do in order to make things work for me. You know, you sent me a video a couple days ago, and just encouraged me, you need to watch this. And I spent some time this afternoon watching that video, and the result is I've got a whole handwritten page here. I started to type it out and I thought, no, I'm going to handwrite this puppy. And I've got the first page out of what will probably be two or three, writing out the aftermath of that video. I'm seeing these are the things that I need to do in order for what I know needs to be done to come to pass. Unless they just become a concept in my brain, I'm going to write them out. So, in Hebrews, I see something.
Before you go there, Barry, I want to ask you a challenge right here. Okay, remember where you're at in Hebrews.
Okay.
I can hear maybe somebody going, "Well, what's the video?" We're not going to give it out in the air. But if you'll email Barry, go remnantofisrael.com, or you'll email me joinedtohashem.org. If you'll email either one of us, we'll send you the video. It's about it goes all the way back to the 1960s.
It's 1962, I think.
But one of the most amazing, amazing speeches that I've ever heard is on this video. So if somebody wants it, you got to email us. We're not just going to do the easy thing so you can forget about it later. We'll send you the link. Barry, go ahead.
So in Ephesians, Hebrews chapter number 5, verse 12. Rachel or whoever the writer of Hebrews says, for indeed, although by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first elements of the word of Elohim, and you have become such as need milk and not solid food. You ought to be doing the teaching, but you're still wanting someone else to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You ought to be at levels 2, 3, 4, or 5, but you're content to sit at level 1 and let someone else do the heavy lifting. We can't, man, when I read this and when I understand the role that Raquel is in, it's like, come on, somebody fix my world. It's just not fair. Never mind that she is a Hollywood starlet in appearance by our estimation. Never mind that she's the primary bride. Never mind that Yaakov loves her more than anything else. She realizes the real value is in children and producing fruit. But I can't. Yaakov, you do it. I don't know how to. I am learning. I have learned in the last year that if I don't know how to do something, I need to either figure it out, go to YouTube University and see if there's a video on it, or go to someone that I know that understands it and ask questions. Before we came on the air, my heat stopped working. And we went out, my son-in-law and I, and tried to diagnose this thing and figure it out. Normally, in getting inside some kind of a unit like that, I let someone else come and start taking it apart. And I didn't think twice, Mike. I grabbed the tools that I needed and started tearing it apart until I could figure out what the problem was. I figured out what the problem was. If I can get a part, I can get it fixed. I don't have to pay someone else to come in, but I have to be willing to learn and get my hands in there and make something happen. In the body of Messiah, we got folks that have been sitting in congregations or sitting in front of video after video. If you never take the information that you're gaining and put it functionally in an application in your life, you're never going to actually learn anything. You haven't learned until you do it.
You know, it's kind of like a person driving down the road and they get a flat tire. Pull over to the side of the road and get their cell phone out and start watching videos of how to change a flat tire. But never get out of the car and open the trunk. At some point in time, you got to get out and get the and open the trunk. You got to act on what, and this goes back to your reconnect a week ago, you have to quit just sitting and absorbing and do something with what you have and then not expect everybody else to be the answer. For Raquel, it's obvious that, you know, that Yaakov, will keep this very, very mild for the mixed audience. It's obvious that Yaakov is doing his part in the relationship for children. Why is it that she couldn't have prayed? She came to Yaakov and said, you need to do the praying for me instead of her praying. What would have happened if she had prayed?
Well, he gets mad at her and says, well, who do you think I am? Elohim's the ones kept your womb closed, not me.
So see, this opened up something. I think with the whole relationship with Yaakov, with Leah and Raquel, this might have been a turning point for him to begin to see Raquel and then to see Leah in a different light. So this brought out something that was inside of her. How could this be related, this thing of she refused to pray for herself, how could that relate to later on when Laban catches up with them, that she is the one that has stolen the household items? I see a correlation there between these two things. Because as she is there and she's dealing with this infertility, this wasn't, you know, when Laban comes and she's sitting on the camel saddle, this wasn't the first time she'd been sitting on her idols. This wasn't the first time she'd been in close proximity to her idols. This wasn't the first time that she was, you know, if this doesn't work out. I mean, I just think that he probably just loves me for my looks. But when those looks are you know, kind of fading, I got to have something to fall back on.
Mm.
She has some things that she's not really dealing with. She has plan B. You know, Leah probably doesn't have plan B in the relationship.
Well, but this time she's got a gaggle of youngins, and she's desperately dependent on Yaakov to help her to feed them. Yeah, she has nowhere else to go. Nowhere else is going to take her and all these kids.
And for those above the Mason-Dixon line, a gaggle is qualified as quite a few. Okay. So just thinking that some folks might not know Grassy Creek language here. somebody's in South Africa going, gaggle?
A gaggle?
A gaggle? How do you spell that? Which animal says gaggle? So that's just a bunch of kids, folks. But yeah, she's going to end up, and this is the amazing thing, she is going to end up giving birth to half of the 12 tribes.
Wow. Well, here's a good time to bring this in then. Being fruitful, being fruit-bearing, is not easily accomplished. It is a painful process. Remember in the garden, Yahweh said to Chava, it's with pain that you're going to bring forth children. We want fruit. We want the evidence that things are going well. We want increase. But you have to be willing to go through the process of what it takes to get there. I think of Yochanan, John chapter 15, where Yeshua said, every branch in me that bears no fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes so that it bears more fruit. So fruit bearing is not enough. You have to bear more fruit. Then he says, as the branch is unable to bear fruit of itself unless it stays in me, neither you unless you stay in me. He says in verse 8, in this my Father is esteemed that you bear much fruit. So there is this process. You become fruit bearing, and then you get cut, and the sap bleeds, and the pain ensues. And that what you think you can't do without the other branches, they get cut off. We've lost relationships. But it's so that you and I can become even more fruitful. And you don't get pruned once in life. Pruning happens again and again. You've done the pruning efforts in Israel. Mm-hmm. You were talking about that a week or so ago, that you cut back much more than what you would think is necessary. Yah always seems to be asking for us to yield to him more than what we're comfortable with and more than we think is needed. But he knows what he's doing. And the understanding is that which is left will fight to survive, will grow exceedingly, and the fruit that is bore will be of extreme high quality. Or else you can have a bunch of little efforts that bears fruit of little quality. So what do you want? I ask people sometimes this question: would you rather have 10% of 1,000 or 1% of 1,000,000? You know, you got to strive. It may seem like the percentages are smaller, but when the produce is huge, that's what you want. You want the bigger investment. You want the more. And we cannot be satisfied with status quo. If we're just mediocre, shoving the gear shift up in neutral, we'll never really accomplish anything significant.
You know, that's what we were talking about on the Remnant Road the other day, was the slave mentality. And this is something I'm going to be teaching on, God willing, in the month of December. But here's another thing, that in order to, we're talking about harvest here. In order to harvest, you got to plant a seed. And, you know, Yaakov is scattered. He is sent into exile. Why? To plant a seed. Actually, you would end up planting like 12 seeds, and he would come back with a great harvest. Yeah. It's called the House of Israel. When we look at the book that is named, you know, his namesake, Yaakov, in the Renewed Covenant, the book of James, wrongly termed, but still, that's, you know, we won't get into that. It says to the 12 tribes that are sown. I believe the right translation of that are sown abroad. The Father understands seed time and harvest. He's the one that put seed time and harvest into action in the first place. He was the first gardener. The Creator is the first gardener. What did he do? He planted a garden.
Yes.
And brought forth a harvest. If we're not willing to plant a seed, but here's the the typical American mentality. I won't bring other countries into this, but if the shoe fits, well, put it on. That in our microwave instant society, it goes against nature. Seeds take time to germinate. Seeds take time to come forth. A harvest does not happen the next day. It takes time.
All right, Mike, you got 1 minute to do what you wanted to do, and that is to deal with the idols that Yaakov tried to leave Haran and Lavan behind, but somebody started bringing some memories out. You know, when we bring our idols, our mindsets, our legends, our superstitions, our doctrines, we're bringing that culture out with us. You need to inspect your baggage.
Yeah, I love what you said there. You know, do we have plan B for the kingdom? Do we have plan B? The Father doesn't. He has plan A. He doesn't have another plan B. You are his plan A. But for us to be for us to fulfill his vision of us being the one and only plan to bring forth fruit in the kingdom, we need to inspect our baggage, and we need to clean out our baggage. You know, it's like Dr. Sakina said he was going to write a song, "When Did My Luggage Become My Baggage?" It's when you forgot to throw away stuff that you didn't really need. Raquel should have thrown things away that she didn't need. If so, she might have also been buried next to Yaakov. We'll be right back.